From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They want to take these kids, my son, as well as all these other children, lock them up, throw away the key. You know, that's a tradition for black males. So they want to keep that tradition going because they want to keep institutionalized slavery alive and well.
Kasepla Bailey, her son Robert, is facing charges of attempted murder and conspiracy for a school fight in Gina High School in central Louisiana. The fight took place amidst mounting racial tension after a black student sat under a tree in the schoolyard where only white students usually sat. The next day, three nooses were hanging from the tree. The six black high school students involved in the fight face up to 100 years in prison without parole. Their case has drawn national attention, raising issues of racism and justice in this country. We'll speak with three of the parents of the Gina Six and with the journalists who broke the story nationally. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Washington Post is reporting Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez assured Congress the FBI respected privacy rights despite receiving reports that violations had in fact occurred. Gonzalez's comments came in April 2005 as he sought congressional renewal of broad laws enforcing power under the Patriot Act. At the time, he told Congress, quote, there has not been one verified case of civil liberties abuse. But internal FBI documents show Gonzalez received at least half a dozen reports contradicting that claim in the 3 months before. The violations included unauthorized surveillance and illegal property search. President Bush has invoked executive privilege to block the testimony of two former aides and deny Congress key documents in its probe into the firing of nine U.S. attorneys. Monday morning was the deadline for the White House to explain its refusal to comply. In a letter to the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, White House counsel Fred Fielding said former Karl Rove aide Sarah Taylor and former White House counsel Harriet Myers were covered under Bush's executive privilege. The Iraqi government is warning of a massive buildup of Turkish troops along the northern Iraqi border. Turkey has accused Iraq's northern Kurdish region of harboring Kurdish militants responsible for cross-border attacks. This is Iraqi Foreign Minister Hossein Abtebin.
There's a huge buildup in our view, in our intelligence assessment, levels up to 140,000 troops. And they have been there for quite some time. We are trying to defuse the situation, to work closely with the Turkish government. And we believe the best way is to revive the working group or the security working group that is made up of the United States, Iraq, and Turkey.
In other Iraq news, reports of deadly U.S. attacks on Iraqi civilians continue to emerge by the day. On Monday, dozens gathered at a mosque in Bakuba to mourn eight family members killed in a U.S. bombing. This is Bakuba resident Sami Yassin Lahif.
Members of my family have been killed by a U.S. airstrike. They were eight members, my parents, two brothers, three kids and my wife. They've been buried here in a mosque in the Mu'allimin area.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate's expected to take up several Democratic amendments to a military spending bill challenging the Bush administration on Iraq. One measure would call for a U.S. troop withdrawal within the next 3 months. The debate comes as an increasing number of Republicans have voiced doubts about the administration's Iraq strategy. On Monday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid urged them to turn words into action.
For those Senate Republicans who are saying the right things on Iraq, they must put their words into action by voting with us to change course and responsibly end this war.
The administration is expected to inform Congress in a mandatory report. The Iraqi government has failed to meet any of its U.S.-ordered political or economic goals. Ongoing chaos on the ground and Republican defections at home have fueled reports the administration would announce an early withdrawal. But White House Press Secretary Tony Snow insisted U.S. troops are in Iraq to stay.
Yeah, there is no intensifying discussion about reducing troops. What there is a real, again, you were talking about a surge that literally just got completed in terms of troop complements 2 weeks ago.
Meanwhile, the top commander of U.S. troops in Iraq, General David Petraeus, has warned the U.S. occupation could last for years. In an interview with the BBC, Petraeus said, quote, I don't know whether this will be decades, but the average counterinsurgency is somewhere around a 9 or a 10 year endeavor. A new poll from Gallup and USA Today shows more than 7 out of 10 Americans want a full U.S. withdrawal by April of next year. President Bush's approval rating has also fallen to a record low of 29%. Meanwhile, a new congressional estimate says the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are now costing around $12 billion a month. Congress has spent $450 billion on the Iraq war alone. Pakistani troops have stormed a mosque in Islamabad, where a hardline rebel cleric has led a standoff for the past week. Initial reports say about 50 militants and 8 soldiers were killed. Up to 500 students, including women and children, are said to be trapped inside. Distraught parents have gathered near the mosque amidst the loud sounds of gunfire from inside the compound. Critics have faulted the Pakistani government for abandoning talks with the clerics. But military spokesperson Major General Wahid Arshad said the raid would continue.
It's going to take some more time. Obviously, it has not ended. And end of the operation does not mean that firing has stopped, so operation has finished. Till the time the whole complex is cleared fully and it is sanitized, only then we term it as the operation has ended. So it is still continuing.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has agreed to send monitors to verify North Korea's shutdown of its nuclear program. The visit will be the first since monitors were expelled in 2002 after the Bush administration accused North Korea of secretly pursuing nuclear activities. Meanwhile, the IAEA has also announced it's sending a team to continue talks with Iran. IAEA Director Mohammad Al-Baradei said Iran is showing signs of slowing down nuclear efforts, but cautioned more monitoring is needed.
This is something for we would continue to report on. This is obviously a decision for Iran to make. They can accelerate the process, they can slow the process, and my hope, my trust that at this stage, at this delicate stage, ideally they will even freeze what they have at the present stage.
In Afghanistan, at least 17 civilians have been killed in a suicide bombing in Uruzgan province. The attack targeted a NATO patrol in a crowded marketplace. At least 30 people were wounded, including 7 NATO troops. In Detroit, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, that's the NAACP, held a mock funeral Monday to mark the symbolic burial of the N-word. Hundreds of people turned out for the event. This is NAACP Chair Julian Bond.
I think the Don Imus controversy gave all of us a heightened awareness of how harmful the spoken word can be. And while we are great respecters of the First Amendment, had there not been a First Amendment, this organization would not exist. But we don't believe it's a violation of the First Amendment to say to somebody, you ought not talk that way. You ought not denigrate women. You ought not condemn people because of the color of their skin. So this, we hope, is sending a message to the world, the country, particularly the world, that there are certain words that ought not be spoken, and the N-word is one of them.
The funeral took place as part of the NAACP's 98th annual convention. And finally, in military news, the U.S. Army has announced it's failed to meet recruiting goals for the second straight month. A Pentagon official said the military was more than 1,000 recruits short of meeting its goal for June. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Gina is a small town nestled deep in the heart of central Louisiana. Until recently, you may well never have heard of it. But this rural town of less than 4,000 has become a focal point in the debate around issues of race and justice in this country. Last December, 6 black students at Gina High School were arrested after a school fight in which a white student was beaten and suffered a concussion and multiple bruises. The 6 black students were charged with attempted second-degree murder and conspiracy. They face up to 100 years in prison without parole. The Gina Six, as they've come to be known, range in age from 15 to 70. Just over a week ago, an all-white jury took less than 2 days to convict 17-year-old Michael Bell, the first of the Gina Six to go on trial. He was convicted of aggravated battery and conspiracy charges and now faces up to 22 years in prison. Black residents say race has always been an issue in Gina, which is 85% white, and that the charges against the Gina Six are no exception. The origins of the story can be traced back to early September, when a black high school student requested permission to sit under a tree in the schoolyard where usually only white students sat. The next day, three nooses were found hanging from the tree. Democracy Now! Correspondent Jackie Suwin has more on the story from Gina.
Black girls over there, black boys right here. Some black people standing right, a couple. All the band geeks right there. And white folks under the tree, and then you might, it's like...
Jesse Beard, a freshman in high school and one of the Gina Six, took us to where the nooses were hung.
We, one day, I just wanted to live about the first, second day, we started riding the bus, me and Robert. And we came through, and I seen something hanging there. I told Robert, he looked at it. He's like, them nooses right there. He was getting mad. I started getting mad. By the time everybody came, they was trying to cut him down.
Robert Bailey, 17 years old and a safety receiver for the school football team, is another of the Gina Six facing life behind bars. He described his reaction to the nooses.
It was early in the morning. I seen them hanging. I'm thinking the KKK, you know. Hanging nooses, don't want to hang somebody.
Real nooses. The ones you see on TV are the kind of nooses it was. The ones they play in the movies, and they were hanging out of people, you know, and that thing drop. That was kind of nooses that were. I know somebody white that hunted nooses in the tree. You know, I don't know what other way to put it, but, you know, I was disappointed. But, you know, we do little pranks. You know, toilet paper, that's a prank. You know what I'm saying? Paper all over the square. All the pranks they used to do, that's pranks. Nooses hanging up, nooses ain't no prank.
The school superintendent dismissed the nooses as a prank, and after 3 days' suspension, the three white students who hung the nooses were allowed back to school. Casepla Bailey, Robert's mother, said the school did not inform the parents of the incident.
The school didn't tell me. I didn't know that it happened, so therefore I didn't call to find out what happened on that particular day.
To Casepla Bailey, the meaning of the nooses was clear.
It meant hatred to the other race. It meant that we're going to kill you, you're going to die. You know, it sent a message. This is not the place for you to sit. This is not your damn tree. Do not sit here. You know, you are to remain in your place, know your place, and stay in your place. You're out of your boundaries. And the first thing now that the sheriff department or that the chief of police want to say that, as well as the superintendent, one had nothing to do with the other. Now, come on now.
Most people we spoke to in Gina's white community, however, see no connection between the students' charges and race. Barbara Murphy, the town librarian, claims there isn't a race problem in Gina.
We don't have a race problem. It's not black against white. It's crime. The nooses, I don't even know why they were there, what they were supposed to mean. There's pranks all the time of one type or another going on. Hmm. And just didn't seem to be racist to me.
A few days after the nooses were hung, the entire black student body staged an impromptu demonstration, crowding underneath the tree during lunch hour. Justin Purvis, the student who first asked to sit underneath the tree, described how the protest came about.
It was like the first beginning, and a couple of them said, y'all want to go stand under a tree? And we said, yeah. And they said, if you go, I'll go. If you go, I'll go. So one person went, next person went, everybody else just went.
The school responded to the protest by calling police and the district attorney. At an assembly the same day, the district attorney, Reed Walters, accompanied by armed policemen, addressed the students. Substitute teacher Michelle Rogers, one of the few black teachers at the school, was there. She recalls the DA's words to the assembled high schoolers.
The kids didn't say anything. They were listening. The kids were quiet. And so, you know, District Attorney Reed Walters, you know, proceeded to tell those kids that I can end your lives with the stroke of a pen. And the kids just was like in awe that District, you know, Reed Walters would tell these kids that. He held a pen in his hand and told those kids that, see this pen in my hand, I can end your lives with the stroke of a pen.
A series of incidents followed throughout the fall. In October, a black student was beaten for entering a private all-white party. Later that month, a white student pulled a gun on a group of black students at a gas station, claiming self-defense. The black students wrestled the gun away and reported the incident to police. They were charged with assault and robbery of the gun. No charges were ever filed against the white students in either incident. Then, in late November, someone tried to burn down the high school, creating even more tension. 4 days later, a white student was allegedly attacked in a school fight. The victim was taken to hospital and released shortly with a concussion. He attended a school function that evening. Six black students were charged with attempted second-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder on charges that leave them facing between 20 and 100 years in jail. The defendants, ranging in age from 15 to 17, had their bonds set at between $70,000 and $138,000. The attack was written up in the local paper as fact, and D.A. Reed Walters published a statement in which he said, "When you are convicted, I will seek the maximum penalty allowed by law."
Yes, we have come today to stand against what we consider to be a great evil. We pray that you would be...
Since their arrest, the defendants' families have been speaking out and fighting for the release of their sons. Two of the six, including Michael Bell, who was recently convicted, were unable to make bond and have spent close to 7 months in jail to date.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
Casepla Bailey began writing letters to state and national agencies, including the Department of Justice, immediately after the charges were filed.
The first thing was devastation. You know, I was down when it first happened. You know, I was very devastated. I was hurt, upset, angry, mad, frustrated. You know, I had so many emotions, crying a lot of nights, you know, trying to figure out where can I go from here. You know, a lot of times when you're backed into a corner, you're backed into a wall, you come out, naturally you're going to come out fighting. You know, you're not going to, you're either going to fall and die, or you're going to come out fighting. You know, I'm just sending out these letters to anyone that would have a, you know, a listening ear, and to anyone that I thought that would, you know, might help this situation. That's how I fight back, you know, by putting the pen to the paper. They want to take these kids, my son, as well as all these other children, lock them up, throw away the key. You know, that's a tradition for black males. So they want to keep that tradition going because they want to keep institutionalized slavery alive and well.
At a friendly pickup game of football, Casepla's son Robert shows off the skills that made him a star player of the high school football team. Robert was in jail for over 2 months before his mother was able to raise the money for her son's bond, using three pieces of property from different family members. 17-year-old Robert Bailey has no criminal record.
I ain't got no criminal record, nothing. I ain't no probation, community service, or nothing. Nothing like that. DA, he ain't out to find the truth. That's what the DA is for, to out to find the truth, you know, of the case. He just, you know, trying to put me up on the jail cell. For your life, it's just 50 years, they 25 to 100 years, you just say, well, 20 years fell to me.
Robert wasn't the only one with a promising future. All of the Gina Six were athletes, and five of the six were on the high school football team. Marcus Bell, the father of 17-year-old Michael Bell, has a stack of scholarship offers for his son.
LSU, Southern Miss, Ole Miss, University of New York.
Michael is a star running back and a strong student who is being actively scouted by a number of colleges.
Well, we're not blaming the victim for the charges or none of that. The DA is a racist DA. You know, I'm not calling him out for being a racist. I'm calling him out as being a racist due to his track record. The reason we is taking a stand for our kids for what he not doing is right, cause, you know, we tired of it. You know, cause if he, you know, we sit down, lay back, and let him railroad our kids too, he gonna continue to do that to black people in this town. You know, so we have to take a stand now. Either somebody take a stand now. If not, it gonna be, he gonna continue to fill the prisons up with black people more and more.
Mr. Bell believes that his son is learning a valuable lesson from this experience.
One of the best lessons that my son could learn. That's one of the best lessons, to know what it is to be black now. You know, if this don't teach him that what it is to be black now, I don't know what will. But he's 17 now. You know, he got a lot of life, ahead of him. And the day he set foot out of jail, I'm gonna tell him. I'm gonna tell him again. You know what it is to be black now. Here it is.
For Democracy Now!, this is Jackie Stewart reporting from Gina, Louisiana.
That piece is from an upcoming feature documentary by Big Noise Films. Michael Bell faces up to 22 years in prison when he's sentenced July 31st. The five other students await trials on charges of attempted second-degree murder and conspiracy. They face up to 100 years in jail. When we come back from break, we'll be joined by parents of three of the Gina Six, as well as the journalist who broke the story nationally. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh, then the sudden smell of burning flesh.
Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. As we turn now to the parents of three of the Gina Six, joining us from Louisiana, Casepla Bailey is the mother of Robert Bailey. Tina Jones is the mother of Bryant Purvis. Both of their sons are awaiting trial on charges of attempted second-degree murder and conspiracy. They join us from Louisiana Public Broadcasting in Baton Rouge. Joining us on the telephone from Gina is Marcus Jones. His son, Michael Bell, was the first of the Gina Six to go on trial. He was convicted just over a week ago of aggravated battery and conspiracy. He faces up to 22 years in prison when he's sentenced July 31st. We'll begin with Michael Bell, because I know that you need to go back to work, talking to us from work. Marcus Jones, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tell us your reaction to the conviction of your son and the time he faces in jail.
And real mad about the conviction, because I know that it was wrong. I know my son is innocent of the charges that the DA put on him, and it's just wrong. You know, this is just a 2007 modern day court lynching here.
In your own words, tell us what you understand took place.
Well, what I understand that took place is wrongdoing. The judge let the DA just choose an all-white jury. It's an all-white jury, relatives of some of the jurors were some of the witnesses too. One of the boys that testified for Barker was one of the boys that hung up the nooses at the high school.
Was that brought out in the trial?
No, that wasn't brought out in the trial. See, we had a complication with my son's court-appointed lawyer, and come to find out that he was working with the DA for to get my son convicted.
Explain the lead-up to the fight, and then how you understand the fight taking place, Marcus Jones.
Well, my understanding of how the fight took place is Barker was telling some of the boys earlier that morning, calling them nigger and talking about the fight that happened the previous weekend there. So majority of the creation of the fight was due to Justin Barker's racial remarks. But see, we got to go back and understand, see, the DA created this whole racial atmosphere where he didn't do nothing to the boy that hung up the nooses, so that gave the message to all the black kids, well, the white kids could do what they want to do and get away with it. And that ain't right. I don't care what town, what city you live in, that is not right.
The court-appointed lawyer, when the jury pool was all white, did he challenge it at all?
No, he did not challenge it. Now, see, remember, before the jury was even selected, the judge had called all the witnesses up front. So he put me and my son's mother on the witness list, not informing us that he was going to do that. Now, what made him do that, I don't know. But right then and there, we smelled the rat. So the judge had put a gag order on all the witnesses where it couldn't be present in the courtroom, couldn't talk to the press, couldn't talk to nobody on outside the courtroom about the case. So right then and there, we smelled the rat then.
And were you called up to testify?
No.
So you couldn't speak about the case and you were kept out of the trial?
Yes, the whole while. We was allowed, only time we was allowed back in the courtroom when the verdict came back.
Did your son's court-appointed attorney call up any witnesses?
No, he did not put up no kind of defense at all. He did not call one witness. There was a coach that had wrote a statement out saying that he didn't, that Michael wasn't the one was involved in the fight, that didn't hit Barker.
So Justin Barker.
He must subpoena him. Now, remember, in the school system, a teacher or a coach, any administration word or statement is more credible than any student. So he had a coach subpoena for her to come testify for Michael. And he was Michael Key witness.
What are your plans now? Are you keeping this attorney? This attorney wanted Michael to plea bargain?
Yes.
Why did Michael choose not to plea bargain?
Because he wanted Michael to take a plea. Well, see, you got to remember, anytime a plea bargain be threw on the table for any man, here in LaSalle Parish, that person is in it. Here in LaSalle Parish, whenever a black man is offered a plea bargain, he is innocent. That's a dead giveaway here in the South. So he was putting pressure on Michael, threatening him, you know, about the time, you know, he going to get it. Oh, he ain't going to be able to play no football no more. And his life is over with. You know, just that old Jim Crow intimidation method that he was using for to try to get my son to take a plea bargain. So he lowered the charges down on my son from a lesser charge, but it was still, all of it is still felonies. But he wanted Michael to give away information for the plea bargain, give away information about who all else was involved in there. Well, Why are you going to try to trick him and lie to him for to do something that he innocent of if you have all this hardcore information about who was involved in it? You shouldn't even be trying to manipulate no young man's mind like that. And the court-appointed lawyer, I mean, he was just playing right along with the DA.
Are you able to get another lawyer?
Oh, not at this moment.
Well, I want to thank you, Marcus Jones, father of Michael Bell, the first of the Gina Six to be convicted. His son on July 31st faces up to 22 years at his sentencing. Joining us again at Louisiana Public Broadcasting is Kasep LaBailey and Tina Jones. They're mothers of two of the other young men who have been charged, who face trial. Kasepla's son is Robert Bailey. Tina Jones's son is Bryant Purvis. Kasepla, talk about the upcoming trial of Robert. When do you expect that he will be tried?
We're expecting that he will be tried during September, October time frame, according to his lawyer, Mr. Samuel Thomas.
And does your son have a different attorney than Michael Bell?
Yes, ma'am.
The charges exactly that your son faces?
The charges that Robert L. Bailey Jr. faces are attempted second-degree murder, conspiracy to commit second-degree murder, theft over $500, aggravated second-degree and battery, and conspiracy.
Kasepla, can you talk about the fall, how it all took place? We saw part of it in the piece that we played at the beginning of the broadcast, but what you understood was happening from the time that the teenagers challenged the so-called white tree and went to sit under it.
From my understanding, a student asked if it would be okay for them to sit under the tree, and the principal responded and said, sure, you can sit anywhere. This is your campus as well. And after the student went and sat under the tree, as a matter of fact, I think he wanted to be cool. It was so hot that day. So him and a couple of his friends went and sat under the tree, and the following day there were three nooses under the tree.
And then can you talk about the tensions rising in town?
Well, the tensions were very high in town. As a matter of fact, on the day of the incident, I hadn't heard anything about it. I heard it the following Tuesday, which had happened on a Thursday. And the following Tuesday, that's when the community, African-American community, decided to get together and have a meeting at LNA Baptist Church so we can call in professional leaders and lawyers and leaders of the community to come together and try to solve this issue and find out what is the problem, what is the purpose. And really, everybody was really highly upset that this type of thing would happen in a millennium.
And what happened after that meeting?
Well, after that meeting, we had spoken with a few lawyers out of Alexandria, Louisiana. And from that meeting, they were supposed to meet with the NAACP state president, Mr. Ernest Johnson. And from that, they went on and did several television news stories about the incident. But all of a sudden, it just faded out.
And can you talk about the fight before the final fight, the fight where a young black man was beaten at a party?
That young black man was my son, Robert Bailey. Him and some friends had gone to a party at the Gina Fairbairn. And to my understanding, it wasn't an all-white party there. It was a few blacks that was already there in the party. And he asked to enter the party if it would be okay for them to come in. And he said, the lady responded that, sure, you know, as long as there be no fighting. So once he did enter the building, a gentleman asked him what was his name. He told him Robert Bailey. Now, asked him, is your name Robert Bailey? And my son said yes, and Justin Sloan hit him, as well as his sister, Jessie Sloan. And from there, he was attacked by several white men in the Fairbairn. After the incident happened, his other friends came in to assist him. And once the police got there, the police told the black kids that they need to get back to their side of town. So that's where a lot of racial tension is also coming from, our town cops in Gina, Louisiana.
And the incident where your son tried to get a gun from a man at a convenience store?
Well, that incident happened on Saturday, December 2nd, the following day, where Robert and two of his friends, Theo Shaw and Ryan Simmons, were going to Gotta Go Grocery. And once they got there, they see Matt Windham, who is a man, not a student at Gina High School. And Matt Windham, I guess they come upon each other because Matt Windham was involved the previous night with the white gentleman that beat my son the previous night at the Fairborn. Well, rather attacked my son at the Fairborn. So once they came upon each other, I guess it was on. You know, Matt ran to his truck, from my understanding, pulled a shotgun, a sawed-off shotgun with a pistol grip. And my son wrestled with him to get the gun from him. And the other two gentlemen proceeded into fight. And they took the gun from him and left the scene running. You know, I'm sure they were, I know they were in fear of their lives. They were afraid that this man was going to shoot them, you know, especially in the back, running away from the scene. So they were scared. I'm sure Matt Windham was scared. You know, but he chose to run to the truck and pull the shotgun.
Were any authorities intervening at this point? And in the case of your son being attacked, did anyone get charged?
In the beginning, no one was charged for the first 3 to 4 days. And then thereafter, for the first, probably the first couple of weeks after that. I don't know when Justin Sloan was charged, but he was charged with just simple battery. But the other gentleman, as well as his sister, was not charged with any crime. I mean, you know, they talk about conspiracy, and they talk about attack of a white student at Gina High School. What about my son, whom was attacked at a function within the town city limits?
In addition to Cassette LaVallee, we're joined by Tina Jones. She's mother of Bryant Purvis, another of the Gina Six, the six young men who are now charged, who were originally charged with attempted second-degree murder for a fight in the schoolyard. Talk about Bryant Purvis. How old is Bryant, Tina?
Bryant is 18. He turned 18 when he was in jail.
When did he go to jail?
December 5th.
The day after the fight?
Yeah, he went the day after the fight, yeah.
And how long has he remained in jail?
He was in jail two nights and 3 days, yeah.
And then you were able to bail him out?
Yes.
Talk about what he was saying in the lead up to the fight and then your understanding of the December 4th fight.
Most of the information that I gathered was from just being at work and other parents and kids. Bryant is not the type of kid that just, you know, just come home and tell what's going on. Because when they hung the nooses and everything, I heard about it at work. And when I come home, I asked him about it. He said he didn't actually see the nooses hung, but he did see the ropes. Because by the time that he had come out to the yard, you know, they had cut the noose part of it off. But he was affected by and upset by all of it himself, but he didn't actually see the noose part hanging on the rope.
And what about the gatherings that you had to try in the community to try to deal with this before the final fight?
I didn't attend but one of them, and it seemed to be very productive, but after the meeting, it didn't really go anywhere. But, you know, that night everybody was on fire and was going to do so much. But in the end, nothing really come of it.
What date do you expect your son to be tried, Tina?
My son haven't even been arraigned, so we don't have an arraignment date or a court date. So I'm just, I mean, I don't know. I just wake up every morning wondering myself.
Kasepla, can you tell us a little about your son, Robert? How old is he?
My son, Robert, is 17 years old. He was a junior at Gina High School, football, basketball player. And he's a musician at several of the churches here in Gina, Louisiana. He's as well as a bootleg barber. You know, those are that's a barber that's in the neighborhood that's not really licensed to cut hair, but he's a very good barber within the neighborhood.
After the fight, how long was he in jail, Robert?
Robert was in jail approximately about 4 months from December 4th, the day of the fight, until April 3rd. 2007, I'm sorry.
How were you able to get him out?
At the time of his arrest, we weren't able to get him out due to the high bail, which was $138,000, without having a previous criminal record or anything. And we had to come together as a family and come up with three different pieces of property in order to get Robert out once the bond had been reduced to $84,000. So that's how we were able to get Robert released from jail on April 3rd.
How divided has this made, Gina, in terms of white and black, the community 85% white? Do you have any white support?
The town has been divided pretty much for a long length of time, and it's really has been divided even farther apart now since this incident has happened. A lot of people don't want to take their heads out of the sand and say, you know, we have a problem. They want to walk around with blinders on. They're afraid of, you know, making a white man mad. They're upset because some of the things that we are doing as the NAACP unit that's been formed since all these type of things, racial injustice has happened in Gina. So there is a divide. Now, we do have white support, but they will not come out to the public. You know, they will do it behind closed doors, but a lot of the whites would not come before the camera and say, hey, I do support what is happening to your children.
We're going to break, and then we're going to continue this discussion. We're joined at Louisiana Public Broadcasting in Baton Rouge by Kasepla Bailey, mother of Robert Bailey. Tina Jones, thank you for joining us, mother of Bryant Purvis. Marcus Jones was speaking to us on the phone. His son was just tried and convicted. Michael Bell faces 22 years in jail. When we come back, we'll be joined by the local head, the secretary of the LaSalle Parish NAACP, as well as the journalist who broke the story nationally, Jordan Flaherty. Stay with us.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. Nina Simone, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we look at the town of Gina, we're joined from Baton Rouge, Louisiana Public Broadcasting by Jordan Flaherty. He's a journalist and community organizer from New Orleans. He broke the story about the Gina Six, an editor of Left Turn magazine. Also joining us is Katrina Wallace, the secretary of the LaSalle Parish chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. She happens also to be Robert Bailey's stepsister. Jordan, talk about how you came to break this story, what you learned when you learned it.
Well, you know, first, I really want to give all credit to the families that have really been organizing in Gina. I want to say, in the civil rights movement, the rural South was so important as the front lines of the movement, and people were organizing in the grassroots to do that, and they had institutional infrastructure support from organizations like SNCC and Congress of Racial Equality. And right now, a lot of those organizations don't exist as much. And the folks from GINA had to really be organizing on their own. I'm so inspired by Casepla and Katrina and the folks from GINA, Marcus, all those folks, Lisa, who are organizing to make this happen. And they did it really without institutional support. Some folks came, like this person, Alan Bean, from Friends of Justice, based out of Tulia, who's been organizing around these kind of cases of disparate sentencing in Texas and Louisiana and going out and supporting families. And he was one of the folks that really put together the facts and the information and helped spread the word. I also heard about from the ACLU chapter of Louisiana, who had also been going out and giving some support and spreading the word. But I really want to give all the credit to the families who have really been fighting this on the grassroots level, organizing and getting the word out on this really horrendous, heartbreaking series of events.
Paint a picture of GINA for us.
Well, I'm sure Ms. Casepla and Katrina could do it better than me, but I can say it. You know, it's small town, rural Louisiana, central, kind of northern central Louisiana. I want to say during the Civil Rights Movement, the Deacons of Defense, which was an armed self-defense organization during the Civil Rights Movement, was based not so far from there in Monroe, Louisiana, about a half hour north. It's an area that I guess the parish is about 85% white. I think it's about 2,500 people in the town of GINA. Mm-hmm. About 350 black folks, is that about right? And so, and there, it's fairly divided, right, where you've got more black section of town, a white section of town.
Yes.
You have a elementary school that's mostly white, and then an elementary school that's more mixed, and then the high school is more mixed, black and white.
Yes.
So you have, you know, a still very Jim Crow system set up in the town in many ways. The high school is, as I think folks have already talked about, was very divided between the black and the white part of the high school. And what this is really about, though, is the two systems of justice, a system of justice for black folks and white folks. And this goes back decades, you know, in this town, of course, in the South and in this country overall. And that's what we're seeing here. There's the system of justice for white folks in GINA and for black folks in GINA, just as there's a system for folks like Scooter Libby, who gets his sentence commuted by the Bush administration, and then there's the sentence for everybody else that doesn't have the personal favors, that doesn't have the white system of justice and the power structure behind them.
Aggravated battery, what Michael Bell was charged with, has to have a dangerous weapon in Louisiana, under Louisiana law. Explain the weapon, Jordan.
Tennis shoes. It was they're using his sneakers. And, you know, let's remember this was originally attempted murder, and then they lowered it to aggravated battery. And it is such a miscarriage of justice. I don't think there's anyone around that would doubt that if this had been a fight between black students or a fight of white students beating up a black student, you would never be seeing this. And it's completely about race. It's completely about two systems of justice. And it's heartbreaking to me. And I just want to encourage folks to support these families. I think, you know, they need legal support. They need all the support that they can get in this struggle, which I think people all around the country are facing this. This issue of sentencing disparity is something people are facing everywhere. But GINA is such a clear example and such a heartbreaking example. And I think it's really important that we draw the line here and that we stand up and say that this is not acceptable.
Now, Justin Barker, the young white man who was beat up on December 4th, was he hospitalized overnight? How seriously was he beaten?
I'm sure it was a serious fight, and I'm sure it deserved real discipline within the school system. But he was out later that day at a ring ceremony. He was smiling. He was with friends. So he was not hospitalized overnight. It was certainly a serious school fight, but it was not aggravated battery. It was not a serious criminal charge. It was a serious school disciplinary problem. And it was also a serious school problem that came on the heels of a long series of other events, including, as we've already talked about, the black student being beaten up by white students, including black students being threatened with a shotgun. All of this series of events, nooses being hung outside the school, very serious series of events that were not taken seriously when white students were perpetrating them on black students. But as soon as black students were involved, then that's when the hammer came down. And as it's been discussed, Reed Walters, is it district attorney of the town?
District attorney.
District attorney of the town came out, and he said, I will I can make your lives disappear with a stroke of a pen. And what he was responding to was black students standing up against racism. It was when black students went under that tree and said, we're not going to put up with these nooses under the tree. That's what made Reed Walters concerned, the black students standing up. And then he came back again when black students got in a fight with white students. That is what they wanted to shut down.
Jordan, explain how it worked that the jury pool, not just the jurors in this jury were all white, but the jury pool who showed up to the court room were all white.
Well, you know, you have a town that's already 85% white, so that's going to cut people out already. And then you have the districting where most of the black folks from the town are cut out from the town through the districting, so they're cut out from it. I don't know, do folks want to say, that's the main thing, the various ways in which people are cut out of the jury pool.
In the various articles written about it, the discussion of some of these jurors being friends with the DA, with the district attorney.
Mm. Yes.
Kasepla, right, would you like to elaborate on that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, as Marcus Jones stated, that one of the young men that testified was a friend of Justin Barker, as well as the student identified as the student that put the noose in the tree. And also, one of the witnesses' mother is a close friend as well as co-worker, works for Justin Barker's mother, Kelly Barker, as a manager over at Walmart in Gina. Mm-hmm. So there are some close ties, and there was also the only male that was on the jury was a classmate of Justin Barker's dad, who is David Barker. So there are a lot of family ties, there are a lot of friends, there are a lot of things that connect together, you know, as the DA pulled these jurors to be on this witness against Michael. And the thing that is very, very disturbing is the fact that Michael's attorney accepted this all-white jury. From my understanding, I'm not a lawyer, from my understanding, he could have objected to these jurors. And I know that Marcus Jones tried to attempt to pass him something, a note, to let him know about those that were on the jury that day.
I wanted to bring Robert's stepsister and secretary of the LaSalle Parish chapter of the NAACP in Gina, into the conversation. Katrina Wallace, what is the NAACP doing about this situation right now?
Well, right now, the thing we're understanding about the NAACP, when we joined, we had to organize for ourselves. So now that we're organized, we have to do it on our own, and whatever they can do to help us, they can do. But as a group in Gina, as an organization in Gina, we're just fighting the injustice system there. We're not giving up on these kids, because what they're doing to these kids is unjust. For a simple school fight, you get 100 years in prison. And to go back to that, this type of thing has always happened in Gina. You know, fights at school, more than one person jumping on one single person. I mean, a black man got beat up by a group of white men. I mean, this goes back to when the schools were integrated. So I don't understand how they took all this out of context and to say, hey, Justin Barker got jumped on, we're going to charge these kids with murder. It's not right. So us as an organization, you know, we protest, we're protesting, we're calling out to people, we need help. I mean, we need to get these kids lawyers. So we set up a Gina 6 defense fund. So if anybody out there, if y'all can help us, the address is P.O. Box 2798, Gina, Louisiana, 71342. We need all the help, lawyers, if you can come help us protest, we need that also.
I do want to say we also tried to get the DA on the broadcast, and we weren't able to do that. But we will put a link to, we will put that address on our website as well, Katrina.
Thank you.
And
I
also wanted to ask Jordan about the prison, the detention facility in Gina that you've written about extensively. It has undergone many changes. The notorious Gina juvenile facility was closed because of, well, how bad the abuses were inside. And then what happened after Katrina?
Well, after the storm, folks from Louisiana were in Orleans Parish Prison, which was the prison, the city jail in New Orleans. It's the eighth largest city jail in the country. And they were left behind in the storm. And then several days afterwards were evacuated first up to Hunt's Prison in upstate Louisiana, and then moved to various prisons, including the Gina facility was special, opened up for the folks from New Orleans. And there was major reports of abuses there. And, you know, that is another aspect of Gina. It's like many towns, sort of a company town for the prison, where a lot of folks from Gina have worked in the prison. And that's a major job for folks, including many of the family members involved in this case, and many people in the town overall. And I think that you know, that has an effect on any community, I think, when that's the main employment in the town is this prison. And my understanding is a company, I think it's GEO, has bought up the prison to open it up again, I think not as a juvenile, but as an adult facility. Mm-hmm. And in general, we're seeing that all over the country, more and more prisons being built. And once you have a prison, you have to fill it with people. You know, it's a cycle that just keeps perpetuating itself. And Louisiana has the highest incarceration rate of any state in the U.S. If Louisiana were a country, it would have the highest incarceration rate of any country in the world. And we're just locking up more and more people. It's a state where vast disparities exist in sentencing, where overwhelmingly it's black folks that are sent in these prisons. You have places like Angola Prison, which was a former slave plantation, where people still do there a lot of the work that folks did during the times of slavery. It was named for Angola because a lot of the folks originally in there as a slave plantation had come from Angola. And 90% of the people in that prison will die in that prison. Mm. And that's, you know, a state that we're seeing in prisons all around Louisiana. People, it's not about reform. It's not about rehabilitation. It's about people being sent there to die.
I'm looking at a press release from Human Rights Watch, and it's about the prisoners who were taken to the Gina Correctional Facility after the evacuation, after Hurricane Katrina. Human Rights Watch urging the Secretary of the Louisiana Corrections Department to end the abuse of prisoners and start an investigation. The prisoners saying at Gina that correctional officers had beaten and kicked and hit them while they were shackled. In addition, they claimed that officers forced inmates to stay kneeling for several hours at a stretch, then hit them if they fell. They also say officers sprayed the walls with chemical spray that prisoners believe was mace and forced inmates to hold their faces against the sprayed walls. The prisoners became ill and vomited. Officers wiped their faces and hair in the vomit, they said. Now, that was the facility that's been closed. Now, GEO reopening, that's GEO, which is now the new name for Wackenhut that ran the previous facilities. That's just a picture of another part of Gina. But I'm going to end with you, Kasepla Bailey, mother of Robert Bailey. We just have about 30 seconds left. But what would you like to leave with people around the country and around the world who are watching to and listening this broadcast?
I would like to leave this message to the people of the United States that we are asking for a plea to the governor of Louisiana, Governor Kathleen Blanco, to come in and assist, investigate, and do as she needs to do on this case with Michael Bell as well as other Gina Six.
I want to thank you all for being with us. And finally, Katrina, one more time, that address that you gave out, Katrina Wallace, Secretary of the LaSalle Parish NAACP.
Yes, it's the Gina 6 Defense Committee, P.O. Box 2798, Gina, J-E-N-A, Louisiana, 71342.
I want to thank you all for being with us, Katrina Wallace, Kasepla Bailey, and Jordan Flaherty. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org is our website. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shruv Hagokadoosh, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Anjali Kamat, Jay Babalota, Jeffrey Hagerman, Nicole Salazar. Special thanks to Kouros Ismaili and Jackie Suen. I'm Amy Goodman, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.